Father, thanks for this time to be together to learn from you again. Father, open up our hearts and our minds and especially our lives to your word and to some principles that are somewhat basic and yet at the same time very complex, because it's not what we know that really matters, it's what we do with what we know. Help us to be doers of our faith and not merely hearers. Help us to understand that our Christianity is to be lived and not just thought. And Father, cause us to be true worshipers by allowing you to change our lives. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. One of my favorite stories is about a violinist, and one night after he had given one of his greatest concerts of his incredibly brilliant career, Paderewski was greeted by an over-eager fan, and this fan said to him, "Oh, I'd give my life to play as good as you do." And silently, almost reverently, Paderewski responded by saying, I did. And that's a great illustration of what Jesus calls us to, isn't it? When you think of your Christian life, sometimes we think about the things that we do, but the very thing that Jesus calls us to is a life of total commitment. Actually, losing one's life given totally over to him. And that's what Jesus meant, didn't he, in Matthew chapter 10, verse 39, when he says, "And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life shall lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake shall find it." As far as Jesus is concerned, if you want to find your life, if you really want to have meaning, you have to throw your life away. You ever thought about it like that? You got to get rid of your own desires and only pursue his desires. And that goes totally contrary to our worldly philosophy, to our what I call commercial philosophy. You've heard it. Grab all the what?
Gusto.
Because you only go around once in life. And you know what? I bet you there's none of you in this room, maybe none of you, who have never taken a shot of Slitz beer. But I would really challenge you and maybe ask you to examine yourself to see if you're not shot through with the Schlitz philosophy to grab all the gusto in this life instead of throwing your life away and only following Jesus Christ. And that's a good question for us to ask. And that's why we're studying aggressive Christianity. And we've been looking at 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27. I want you to look there again, okay? Let's continue to read it together. It's really important when you study the Bible that you read the Bible, even though you read it over and over again. So let's read it. "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may..." What?
Win.
Oh, you're getting better now. "And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in..." How many things?
All
things. "They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. Therefore, I run in such a way as not without aim." I know where I'm going. "I box in such a way as not beating the air." I hit my target. "But I buff up my body and I make it my slave, lest possibly after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified." Now, what we've talked about already, remember in our last couple times together, we've talked about the type of race that we're in. We've talked about the talent that we'll need to win our race. And we've talked about the test of our race, or the attitudes that are needed to win. And what I'd like to do tonight is take a look at the first half of verse 25. Let's look at it again. "And everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things." And first, what I want to do tonight, and you'll see that in your outline, is to examine the cost of the Christian life. The cost of the Christian life. Now let me ask you a question. If Paderewski was willing to give his whole life to be a great violinist, shouldn't we as Christians be willing to give up our whole lives to accomplish God's work for his kingdom? And the obvious answer is what? Yes. Why don't we?
Weights.
What else? Why don't we? What keeps us from giving our life totally to Christ?
Laziness.
Doubt.
Lack of faith.
Okay, lack of knowledge of what a true Christian is.
Very good. What else?
Selfishness. Excellent. Well, that's not excellent, but it's an excellent answer. What else?
Fear.
Fear. Very good.
Pride.
Peer pressure.
Confusion.
Sin. That's pretty general. That's good. What else? Anything? Those are good answers. I want to suggest one. And the one is why we don't really achieve that kind of commitment to Jesus Christ is because we haven't counted the cost. We don't know what the cost is involved in the cost. And according to verse 25, the cost of your Christianity involves three things. And you can see that there in your outline. You can see two things, our call and our competition. And we're going to look at both of those in this first session, and then we're going to look at the final quality, which is, I think, the missing element in American Christianity, which we'll talk about. Three items. Number one, let's look at our call. Look at verse 25 with me again, and notice that it starts with an interesting phrase. It starts with, "and everyone who," and everyone who. Now, in the Greek text, a more accurate translation would be this. Now, watch this. "And everyone who now competes in the games." Now, you might think that that's just a kind of a minor difference, but I want to call your attention to that again. It says in your New American Standard, if that's what you have, "and everyone who," but really what it should be written in there, and you might even want to write it in your Bible, "everyone who now competes in the games." In other words, it's not an "and," but it's a "now." The word "and" there should be translated "now." Now everyone who competes in the games. In other words, the word "and" should be translated "now," which means that it's not everyone who chooses to compete in the games. In other words, what I'm trying to point out to you here is that a choice is not involved in what he's saying. It's not, well, if you choose to be involved in competing in the games, he's saying everyone who now is in the games. And what the text is saying is that you don't have a choice, Christian. You are going to compete. You are going to run in a race. It's not an option. When you become a Christian, you run your race. You will run. And if you don't run your race, it means you're not a Christian. Because you're called to run. All Christians run. The question is, and you need to ask yourself as well as myself, will you run your race? Now imagine for a moment that you're translated from here to some athletic field, okay? You're there. Now you're sitting or standing and you're watching all these other great athletes, some of the greatest that you've ever known in history and some of the greatest that still exist today. And you discover that each runner has been given a week to train and run their best race against only themselves, and you find that you too must be training and you too must run your race. All right? You're there, you're on the field, you've got a week. What are you going to do? Really? You've got to compete. You've got to run in a race, but you're not going to run against them, but you're going to have to run at the same kind of course that they're going to have to run. What are you going to do? Would you give up? Would you say, no way, forget it? Would you go and hide somewhere? Say, I can't do it. Would you train but not run? Would you give it a half-hearted effort and say, well, gosh, what am I going to do against all these greats? Or would you go all the way and get all you got? I really believe that the very few Christians really give it all they've got in their race, even though that's what Christ calls you to. In other words, he's given you kind of a course to follow that you're supposed to give your all no matter what the circumstances you find yourself in. Too many Christians are saying, it's too hard, why even try? I'll just fail again. You ever felt that way? I have. You fall down, and you don't want to get back up. Kind of like Eric Little, remember him? In Chariots of Fire? He was pushed down in an early race, and he could have laid there going, oh, this is unfair, or run to the judge and scream foul. He could have laid on the ground and, you know, beat the ground, or all kinds of options. He could have done what Mary Decker did, you know, and just lay there and cry. But he didn't do that. What did he do? Almost without losing momentum, he curled around, rolled back onto his feet, and ran the race and won the race. You see, I think very few Christians have that kind of commitment in their Christianity. We commit ourselves to other things, but we don't really commit ourselves to running our race hard. Too many Christians are hiding in churches. Do you hide in church? I mean, hide? Especially at Grace Church, you know, a large church. You can really hide here, can't you? You can just kind of find a place in a pew and not do anything but appear to be an incredible Christian. You can say all the prayers. You can attend fellowship. You can honor Christ. You can even give grace at meals. Maybe even risk doing it at a restaurant. But you don't live a Christ-centered life. You don't live a life centered on Him. You're not given totally over to Him. You're definitely not running for Him. Too many Christians get all ready and then do nothing. You ever known a Christian like that? Especially Christian college students. They go, they train, they train, they train, they train, they get out and they fall down and they just lay there. Some Christians give until it hurts and then they quit. Like, I'll serve, but not when it hurts me, or not when it costs me, or not when I have to give up my pleasure, or give up my desires, or give up my, you know, my hopes and dreams. I'm not going to serve if it costs me. So their service is on a condition. See, Christ calls Christians to die how often? Daily. Daily. We're to die daily. To abandon ourselves to His will, to His yoke, all for His glory. Now, if I was around all those great athletes, I think, at least I'd hope, that I'd be inspired to be challenged to do my very best. I would hope that by viewing their lives, I'd want to be all that I could be in my race, because of watching their example. And that's why, did you notice in Hebrews chapter 11, when we talked about it before, that it talks about Joseph, Moses, David, Samuel, and they were all paraded before the reader to inspire him and her. And then in chapter 12, it says, now you run. Now it's your turn. You see where the writer was going? He's trying to inspire them. And one of the greatest things that we can do as Christians is to give ourselves to biographies. Not only biographies in the Bible, which I think are the best, but the biographies that are also of great Christians down the ages, and read of their lives to inspire us to imitate their lives, to inspire us to greater commitment to Jesus Christ. What are some great biographies that you have read? Anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah, what? Elaine's Alarm, an early Puritan writer. Excellent. What else? Anybody else? How about Shadow of the Almighty? Anybody read that? About Jim Elliot? Or how about Lords of the Earth? About Stan Dale? Or other biographies? Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret? Yeah, great books like that are the type of books that you as a Christian can give yourself to, and some of them are absolutely captivating. Absolutely, you can't put them down. And they will give you a greater height and a greater awareness of what you could be as a Christian. And that's why we bring that up. You know, have you ever read Fox's Book of Martyrs? I mean, I've read through that, and I used to get really excited about the incredible commitment that these people expressed. And the interesting thing about Fox's Book of Martyrs was I asked myself the question, why isn't today like their day? And why don't Christians act like these Christians, you know, who gave their lives for Jesus Christ? And I think the answer is that they understood the cost. The cost was very obvious to them. It's kind of like Romania today. To be a Christian in Romania, you got to be willing to give up your family, give up your life, give up your job, give up everything that's meaningful. And that why, when they begin to count the cost of becoming a Christian, then they, when they make that decision for Jesus Christ, you can almost rest assured that that individual is truly born again. They truly have a relationship with Jesus Christ, and they're really going to go for it because their life's on the line to give their life to Christ. It's kind of like a baseball game. You know, it's your turn now. It's your turn. I want you to understand that. You see, Jesus was up in the first century, right? And Jesus hit a home run. And then the apostles were up to bat, and they hit a home run. And all the saints down the ages have hit their hits and home runs. And during the Middle Ages, there was kind of a seventh inning stretch. And we're down to the bottom of the ninth. And you're up to bat. This is your time. This is your chance. What are you going to do? Are you ready to hit a homer, or are you just going to try and get on base, or just try and, you know, earn a walk? What are you going to do with your Christianity? You know, when you look at the athlete, it's such an incredible analogy to really begins to display what Christianity is all about. The cost is basically everything. If you look at any good decathlete, you'll see two things behind a decathlete. Are you ready for this? Here they are. Every decathlete has behind him a world of painful injuries and a good doctor. And that's nothing different from what Christianity is all about. You've got to have a way to begin to kind of pick the pieces up and keep going, as well as understand that pain is not an option in Christianity. Hurt and suffering is not an option in Christianity. Those are the things that are going to come your way, whether you like it or not, as a true Christian. So when Paul calls us to compete in the games, whether we like it or not, he is basically in the same breath forever destroying smorgasbord Christianity. You know what smorgasbord Christianity is, don't you? I guess you don't know. Smorgasbord Christianity is like a smorgasbord. You know what a smorgasbord is. You go in, you pay your fee, right? Pick up your plate, and you take a little salad, right? Take a lot of Jell-O. That's what I do. You avoid the beans altogether. You don't even look at the spinach. You pile on the potatoes, and you go back for three desserts. That's smorgasbord. As Christian, Paul says, no longer should we have a little Bible study, a lot of fellowship, avoid service, don't even look at sacrifice, pile on the activities, and go back for three holy kisses. See, that's selective Christianity, and that's not what God has called us to. He's not called us to pick and choose what we want, but to take on exactly what the race is, to understand the call to competition, that there's a price to pay. There is no Christian race without pain as well as joy. There is no Christian race without sacrifice as well as fellowship. There is no Christian race without service as well as tenderness. And the question I have to ask you is your Christianity an off-balanced diet, or is it a well-balanced diet? Do you have a good mixture of the priorities of your Christianity? Or are you extreme in some area and you're totally ignoring some aspect that is essential to your life as a Christian? That's a good question to ask. Not only are we called to the race, but point number two in your outline, we are to compete. We are to compete. He says in verse 25, and look at it, everyone now who competes in the games. The phrase competes in the games is one word in the Greek, okay? Sometimes in our English text, we look at, you know, competes in the games, and we go, boy, that must be three or four different words. In the Greek text, that's really one word. And we get competes in the games from that. And basically, the root of that word is where we get the concept to drive or to lead, kind of like a shepherd who moves his sheep along, kind of a guiding, leading directive. Also, the general idea of that word is to strive in athletics, to contend in the arena, to give it all you've got toward the goal. And the word is basically used in reference to the 10 months of training. Now, I want you to picture this. In the first century, they had a unique way of training. First of all, if you were going to be a great athlete, you would kind of get recognized by just competing in small events. If they saw that you really had a lot of potential, then what they would do is they would kind of call you out of a city as kind of one of the best athletes of that city, and they would ship you to a particular place, a design place, kind of like a Dallas football training camp, you know, where they train in California. Well, they would go some special place to go train. And so then they would go there for 10 months. And they had to submit themselves to all the rules and all the regulations and all the training process. They had to sacrifice their family, sacrifice their friends, sacrifice everything that was normal in life, and they had to do that if they wanted to compete in the Olympic Games. They had to give it their all. And what they would do then is they would submit to this incredible training in any schedule, in any discipline, in order to be proven worthy of being an athlete. And they could walk away from that 10 months of training anytime they wanted to, but if they walked away, they would not be able to come back, and they would not be able to compete in the games.
Please turn your tape to side two.
Some of you may be familiar with a particular naval group that is a very intense training, and it's received kind of some publicity on television. These are the guys who are sent out by our government to go on secret missions. They're kind of your naval aquamen. And basically, the training that they go through, they'll start with a class of 120 and end up with 20 guys. And it's the toughest particular unit of all of the armed services, this particular unit. They have to be able to swim underwater for an incredible length of time with no tanks, you know, I mean, just insane type stuff. At any time during their training, and it gets worse and worse as they continue to go, they can go, throw their helmet down, ring a bell in the main courtyard, and walk away. And they're done. And they're done. And that's exactly what happened in the ancient times. What they would say, at any time they could leave this incredible intense training and walk away, but they could not compete in the race. And though there's no true comparison, that's kind of what I experienced when I was in high school. I was up at Forest Home in a program called the Blue Helmets. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of that. It was a type of thing that every day it seemed like the coach's goal was to get us to throw up, to lose our stomachs. And then when everybody had seemingly gagged or thrown up, they felt that that was, you know, that they had done their job for the day, and then they gave us the rest of the day off. They would make us run up, you know, incredibly high hills at an incredible fast pace. And when you're totally exhausted, then they'd stop you at a wall that was like 4 feet on either side, and they'd make us jump on either side of that wall for like a half an hour to an hour until we all puked and died and screamed for mercy. And then they'd make us run the rest of the way up this hill, and then we'd have to do like 100 sit-ups, 100 push-ups, and all kinds of stuff. It was totally insane. Absolutely insane. And that's the type of training that these guys went through. You know, we think about even the modern, you know, sacrifices that an ice skater has to do with 6 hours of practice a day. That's nothing compared to what these men had to do for 10 months. Of course, they were doing this all their lives, but for 10 months, it was their total life, 24 hours a day. And our race is to be exactly that, what is called for here. Our race never turns off. You never take vacations in your Christian race. Did you know that? There's never a break. It's an endurance race that calls you to total 100% commitment all the time. And that's to be our mentality. We give ourselves to the cause of Jesus Christ every moment, in every situation, at home, at school, at work, with our family, with our friends, on vacation. We're still given to Jesus Christ, totally. Our race is total commitment, no matter what the cost. And I want you to understand it, that the Greek word that is used for compete in the games is, and listen to it, agonizomenos. Agonizomenos. Sound familiar? What word do you hear?
Agony.
It's where we get the English word agony from. And it tells all of us once for all that no matter what the world says, and I've heard it till I'm sick, that Christianity is not a crutch. Christianity is not the weak person's crutch. It's a tough life, and it requires 100% effort on your part. Anybody can float down the current and the tide of society, but it takes a real man or a real woman to swim against it. And that's what Christians do. We swim against the tide and the current and the pressure of our society. The society that is owned by the enemy, Satan's world. And at times, we're going to agonize in our efforts. I mean, anybody can go with the flow, right? You ever floated down a river? That's really easy. Just turn around in your boat and try and paddle upstream, though. That's really when it gets tough. We used to do that in Yosemite. There's a major river that goes right down the middle of Yosemite Valley, and we used to float on mats and float in boats and that kind of thing. But when you try and turn around and you paddle upstream, you don't get very far very fast. And that's exactly what Christians do all day long. We are going against the current and the movement of our world. Anybody can follow their feelings. Anybody can do their own thing. Anybody can live like a gland. Really. Just do kind of what you feel. And isn't that the mentality of the world? If it feels good, what? Do it. That's exactly what the world's saying. You see, our world, even much of the Christian world, and I hate to say this, but it's true, is much like Pavlov's dogs. Remember Pavlov? Dr. Pavlov did experiments with conditioned responses. And he took a group of dogs, and every time he fed them, he rang a bell. Ding, ding. Ding, ding. And so then what... After a surprisingly short period of time, he would ring the bell without feeding the dogs, and the dogs would salivate as if there was food right there. Because they had this conditioned response, ding, ding, and it brought about a drool. And that's exactly what our world and even Christianity is just like. People say certain things and it brings predictable responses. doesn't it? Even in your own life, if you're really honest with yourself, you'll recognize that's true. People say party, ding ding, drool drool. Really? I got to be there, you know, I've got to go, no matter what the cost, no matter what your testimony, no matter what. People say girlfriend, ding ding, you know, date, ding 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 ding. Guy, ding, food, ding, certain kinds of food, chocolate, ding, 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 ding. Coffee in the morning, ding, 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 ding. Drugs, movies, dancing, clothes, fame, gossip, love, flirting, going steady. All those things bring about conditioned responses. And as Christians, we need to begin to recognize that we are not to go with the flow. We are to be those who are so committed to Jesus Christ, we take our signals from Him and His Word. Unfortunately and sadly, many Christians live the same way. And we've given the same weaknesses, the same sins, we've given them Christian names. Have you ever noticed that? Sometimes Christians say, we're going to participate in this particular activity, but really what they're doing is they're sinning, but they're calling it some sort of Christian activity. And they justify it by giving it a Christian name, even though it's a conditioned response. Even though, now listen, it's sensuality, they call it, or we call it, sensitivity. Ever notice that? Guys and girls sometimes trying to be real sensitive to each other and all they want is to get close. Sensual. It's actually lust, but we call it love. It's actually hate, but we call it hurt. It's actually gossip, but we call it gabbing so we can pray for them. Sounds spiritual, doesn't it? It's actually flirting, but we call it fellowshipping. It's actually selfishness, but we call it self-worth. It's actually self-pity, but we call it our sad problems. It's actually stuck, but we call it going steady. How can someone else tell if you're guilty of this hypocrisy? Nobody can. If you're guilty of that kind of hypocrisy, it'll only be you and the Lord who will be able to determine, because it really reflects on your motive and why you do what you do. And if you're going to run your race to win and willing to agonize, you've got to examine yourself. You have to examine your life. You've got to examine your motives many times in even the smallest situation. Now, don't trip out over your motives when you get involved in it, because sometimes you can go, gosh, I want to do what's good, and you end up doing something, and you go, gosh, I wonder if I did it for some other reason. I mean, you can trip out over those things. But it becomes very obvious if your motives are wrong and you're really asking the question, it's very obvious that they're wrong. You'll know right away if you ask the question. Sometimes, as a Christian, you don't know what the answer is. The solution to the problem is you do what's right and say, God, I want my motive to be right because I can't even know my own heart. And I don't know if you've ever been in a situation like that. I experienced that many times. God, I don't know my heart, but so I'll just do what's right and hope and pray that my motive is right and I want it to be right, and so therefore I'm going to assume it's right until you reveal something else to me. But you walk in obedience. It's your heart. It's your motive. It's your internal man or internal woman. It's why you do what you do. And so many church-going Christians have their lifestyle down and the cliches all in order. They have the right external responses, but their heart is wicked, their motives are wrong, and their inner man is sinful. They serve, but only to promote themselves. Is that you? They learn, but only to lord it over someone else. They give so that others are obligated to them. You ever been there? You give a present so that someone else will be nice to you? They desire leadership to be better than other people. They desire to be up front so they can be recognized and be popular. Those are some of the dangerous motives that you find in Christian service. It's amazing that all those great things are corrupted, isn't it? I mean, it's not wrong to want to learn. It's not wrong to want to give. But all those great and good things in our Christianity can be corrupted just when we have a wrong heart, a wrong life, a wrong response. Too many Christians are like the Pharisees who push their faith to the surface, and they live externals instead of focusing on the inner man and making sure that the inner man is right before God. And one of the things I don't want you to get caught up in this particular class, is that you're doing your faith so much, and you're doing your faith so often, that you forget to take care of the inner man, the inner woman. That the real priority is that you be a worshiper, that you be a meditator, that you be one who communes with Jesus Christ. And that's why our first message really focused on the point that Christianity, its goal was who? What was the finish line? Jesus Christ. So we got to keep our eyes on Him. Doing is great, and yes, we are called to do, and if our faith doesn't do, it's not real faith, right? It's dead faith, according to the book of James, which is no faith at all. But at the same time, we should never replace our relationship with Jesus Christ by doing. So we've got to examine the inner man and the inner woman. You see, the Pharisees had a problem. Jesus said it was their heart that was the problem. Because they kept saying, hey, I don't murder. And Jesus says, you hate. That was heavy. Because that cut right into the inner man. They say, hey, I don't commit adultery. And Jesus says, yeah, but you lust. Ooh, you feel the knife twist? That's what He did. He didn't mess around with any of their pious religiosity, and they had tons of it. In fact, they put most of us to shame with their external holiness, really. But Jesus went through the dagger right in and twisted it. And they recognized the truth that they were wicked inside. And that's why Paul says in verse 25 that it's agony, because it's an inner battle. And you know what, Christian? The inner battle never ends. I don't care how holy you look in this life, you will always, always do battle in the inner man and the inner woman. And what you've got to do in your Christian life is you've got to begin to accept the fact that your inner man is where the real battle starts. You need to change yourself from the inside out, not the outside in. Don't let this class convince you that life is a whole bunch of externals. Let this class help you realize that your life starts with the inner man and the inner woman, your spirit. And as that changes, your behavior will change. Your lifestyle will change. Your attitudes will change, and therefore your behavior will change. And it's not going to be easy, and it takes no half-hearted effort. But never forget, Christians, we've got the best. We have been equipped with the very, very best. Don't be discouraged in your inner life, okay? Because we have the toughest race, we have the toughest life, but remember this, we have, number one, the best coach. Who's that? Jesus Christ. He's been there. He has faced all temptation, and yet He didn't fall. You know what that means? Is that the most of what the enemy could throw at me, you know what? I've fallen. But the enemy kept throwing it at Jesus Christ, temptation after temptation. It got so severe, but you know what? Jesus Christ never what? He never fell. He never sinned. And so therefore, He felt the greatest amount of temptation more than any other person, yet without sin. You see that? It's kind of like four trees in a windstorm. And the first one falls at 25 miles an hour. The next one falls at 50 miles an hour. The next one falls at 75 miles an hour. And the next one remains standing, even though it goes 100 miles an hour, 150 miles an hour, 200 miles an hour. That one last tree did not fall. Which tree experienced the greatest amount of pressure? The last one. That's exactly who Jesus Christ is and what He did for us. He experienced all that the enemy could possibly throw at Him, and yet He didn't fall. So He knows what you're going through. He knows the battles that you face. He knows it better than anybody because He experienced all that could be thrown at Him, yet without sin. He never fell. So He experienced all the pressure. He's been there. He ran it, and He won it, and He did it perfectly. Also, number two, we have the winning playbook, the Bible, right? Has the best techniques, has all the warnings, and all the simplest and most basic as well as most complicated instructions that you'll ever need to run your race. And number three, we have the greatest energy, powered by God Himself, the person of the Holy Spirit working inside of us. Now understand this, Christian. You've been called into a race, and you've got to run. You must run, because all Christians will run. Everyone who now competes, you are going to run. And if you don't run, you may be manifesting that you're not one of His. To win, you've got to give it all you've got. To win, you've got to be willing to agonize even over the things you cannot see, your heart and your motives. And it's going to take an essential element that we're going to talk about in just a minute. A man after God's own heart, the writer of many Psalms and a king of Israel, was once in a stronghold away from family and friends, away from all those who loved him, away from the comfort of a situation in which he grew up under. And almost under his breath, he made a wish. He craved for the sweet water of his hometown Bethlehem. And he longed for a drink. Without his knowledge, three of his mighty men overheard his flippant wish. And their response was to go to Bethlehem, the three of them, battle an entire Philistine army, drew up some water from the well, fight their way out, just to fulfill the wish, the kind of flippant, off-the-cuff wish of their king. Isn't that incredible? Shouldn't we be willing to fulfill the express commands of our greater king? Just think about that. Allow David and his mighty men to inspire you to be more of what you could be. Okay?